Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 520, titled Update on White Supremacists and Neo-Nazis, being recorded on August 7th of the year 2005. At the end of this side, I'm going to mention some online resources because there is a vast cornucopia of online resources available on the Spitfire website and on linked websites. For those listeners who only listen to the program, you're missing an awful lot of information. Certainly all of the programs are available on audio online, but there's a tremendous and ever-growing amount of printed information, and I emphatically encourage listeners to take advantage of that. I will go into that, at least to a certain extent, at the end of this side. Now, as should not be surprising for an anti-fascist researcher, I have covered over the years various white supremacist and neo-Nazi organizations and neo-fascist organizations. I don't like the term neo-Nazi because I think somehow it implies that they're less than Nazi. They're not real Nazis, they're just neo-Nazis. Hell no, they're real Nazis, and there are profound links between the old guard and the new guard. Perhaps the most significant and largely overlooked was the fact that an infiltrator or a turncoat in the Order, the Nazi terror group that, among other things, killed Alan Berg, Denver talk show host, in the 1980s, an infiltrator, or actually a turncoat named Martinez, revealed to FBI that, in fact, the Order was receiving financing from, quote, German families, unquote, in Latin America. Three guesses who that might be. There are numerous other links between the old guard and the new guard as well, but hence my distaste for the term neo-Nazi. However, it has passed into usage. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article that supplements information we saw in For the Record program number 164 about the Atlanta child murders. An African-American man named Wayne Williams was convicted in two of the killings and blamed for 22 others, but in fact there is information that suggests the distinct possibility that those killings may have been committed by white supremacists slash Ku Klux Klansmen in the Atlanta area, in part in an attempt to stir up to precipitate riots among the African-American community in Atlanta and perhaps elsewhere. Again, we went into this in For the Record 164, but information about this is now out in the Associated Press. This is an AP story by Harry R. Weber. It's headlined, Tapes May Link Georgia Killings and Supremacist. It reads in part as follows. A white supremacist investigated for a child killing spree that terrorized Atlanta's black community once praised the crimes in secretly recorded conversations obtained by the Associated Press. Although Charles T. Sanders did not claim responsibility for any of the deaths, lawyers for Wayne Williams, the black man convicted in two of the murders and blamed for 22 others between 1979 and 1981, believe the evidence will help their bid for a new trial. Sanders, whose older brother Don was a reputed officer of the Ku Klux Klan, told an informant for the Georgia Bureau of Investigation in the 1981 recording that the killer had, quote, wiped out 1,000 future generations of niggers, unquote. His only complaint was that the killings were prompting police roadblocks. Police dropped the probe into the Klan's possible involvement after 7 weeks, when Sanders and two of his brothers passed lie detector tests, according to the documents released this week to the AP following an open records request. The 315 pages of documents show the investigation started after a source told police that Sanders said the KKK, quote, was creating an uprising among the blacks, that they were killing the children, that they are going to do one each month until things blow up, unquote. The source also told police that Sanders had threatened to strangle one of the children, Luby Jeter, because Jeter ran into Sanders' car with a go-kart. Jeter was later strangled, and Williams was blamed for his death, though never charged. Williams has long contended that he was framed, and that Atlanta officials covered up evidence that the Klan was involved in the killings to avoid a race war in the city. His lawyers believe the materials released to the AP and other evidence they're seeking will help to get him a new trial. They say the investigation into the Klan was withheld from Williams' defense. Quote, there is no doubt that evidence in the hands of the defense and the jury would have at the very least created reasonable doubt at Wayne's trial, unquote, said Williams' lawyer Michael Lee Jackson. Transcripts of multiple wiretapped conversations involving the Sanders family were not released, and authorities won't say if there were any admissions in those talks. In May, the police chief in neighboring DeKalb County, who assisted with the original investigations, said he was reopening the investigation of five of the deaths. So again, that supplements information that has already been presented in For the Record program number 164. It'll be interesting to see ultimately what happens with Wayne Williams' trial. It should be noted that white supremacists and neo-Nazis, again, I don't like the term, but it's passed into usage, have infiltrated and have formed liaisons with various elements of not only police agencies, but also elements of ours and other countries' national security establishments. There are a number of different For the Record programs about that, including one called Specialized Knowledge and Abilities, a multi-part For the Record series that is available for download from the WFMU download website. More about that at the end of the broadcast. In For the Record program number 32, we took a look at the martial law contingency plans that were placed on the books by Oliver North and company in as part of their planning for counterterrorism or for dealing with terrorist incidents or nuclear war or other disasters. Those martial law contingency plans entailed, among other things, the deputization of paramilitary right-wing groups and their empowerment as federal agents. One of the things that should be noted is that the current military is stressed to the max with the occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq. The National Guard, or many members of the National Guard, are out of the country. The reserves are stretched to the maximum. The head of the Army Reserves has stated in no uncertain terms that he is heading a broken force. There has been a lot of discussion on the internet and on talk show and at on bar stools of martial law and people talking about martial law, this and that. Well, one of the interesting things about that is that if, in point of fact, there were to be a crisis of sufficient magnitude to compel the imposition of martial law, there ain't enough marshals around, so to speak, to implement martial law. And therefore, the plans that were drawn up by Ollie North and company under Citizen Reagan would very well be put into effect. And basically, you'd see the Aryan Nation, some of the more reactionary elements of the militia milieu, empowered basically as federal agents. And that is a very unappetizing prospect indeed. One of the things that I would note that is that during the Third Reich's occupation of many of the countries that they conquered, the actual liquidations, the exterminations, were done by various sociopaths and criminal elements in those societies. They were made official Third Reich soldiers, but for example, on the Eastern Front, the Einsatzgruppen were largely composed of gangsters, sociopaths, and other misfits, although they were made soldiers, basically, agents of the Third Reich. And in terms of realizing or speculating about how such a scenario could take place in the United States, the declaration of martial law and the realization of that part of the plans drawn up by Ollie North and company, namely the deputization of paramilitary right-wingers, might very well open the door for official funding of the elements who would conduct such liquidations. This, obviously, is a frightening scenario, hopefully one that won't take place, but yet with much of the Muslim world at this point roused up into a state of lethal animosity towards the United States, with nuclear technology now in their hands and circulating, as well as other lethal technologies, the possibility of just such an eventuality is not one that should be too readily dismissed. And again, as discussed in numerous programs, including For the Record programs 443, 352, and 456, there are operational links between many of the current generation of Nazis and fascists, and some of their Islamo-fascist colleagues. The cement, the unifying element, what I call the underground Reich. Now, in that context, we're going to take a look at the Minutemen. Now, the Minutemen were originally a paramilitary right-wing group in the late 50s and early 60s. The name has been appropriated by a paramilitary group that garnered a tremendous amount of good publicity by patrolling a portion of the Mexican-U.S. border in Arizona in order to stem the flow of illegal refugees across the U.S.-Mexican border. As we're going to see in the article that we're about to examine, the Minutemen received a lot of positive publicity. Perhaps the best element of that was when Governor Schwarzenazzi, or Governor Schwarzenegger as he's generally known, endorsed the Minutemen and indicated that he thought it would be a great idea if they came to California to do the same thing. I would note in this regard that Schwarzenegger is not only a member of a group called U.S. English, originally a group that appears to have been fairly benign and aimed at promoting the development of English language skills by immigrants into the United States, but one that appears to have been co-opted by racist and chauvinistic and white supremacist elements. Schwarzenegger was also a big backer of Prop 187 that was financed in part by the Federation for American Immigration Reform, which in turn has been financed by the Pioneer Fund. The Pioneer Fund is an American eugenics organization that wielded significant influence on the Third Reich's racial laws, and it was financed in part by Wycliffe Draper, who was the cousin of the very famous Draper family, William Draper Jr., William Draper III, and Tim Draper, that not only helped to capitalize Nazi Germany, but are very close to the Bush administration and have been primary elements of the Republican establishment for some time. One of the elements of misdirection, I guess you could say, that the media indulged in was their failure to report something that really should come as no great surprise, the fact that racist, fascist, and white supremacist elements were very much present in the Minutemen milieu. And in fact, many of the organizers of this particular demonstration or exercise hold views dramatically contrary to the way they were represented by the media, who pretty much gave them a free pass. One should consider the Minuteman phenomenon and the martial law contingency plans drawn up by Ollie North and company, which called for the deputization of paramilitary right-wingers, and consider the following. This is from the Online Journal. This is from the Online Journal of May 10th, 2005. The article is by Bill Berkowitz. It's titled, The Minutemen and the Media. It reads in part as follows. Members of the Minuteman Project, the armed group that patrolled a 23-mile strip of the Arizona-Mexico border through the month of April, have gone home, but they're promising to return with, quote, tens of thousands, unquote, more border volunteers in October. If they do return, they may be carrying California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's endorsement with them. Last week, the governor told a Los Angeles radio station that the Minutemen had done a terrific job and that they were welcome to come to California. During the run-up to the month-long patrol, Lou Dobbs, the host of CNN's Lou Dobbs Tonight, gave the Minutemen, quote, millions in free publicity, plugging it for weeks and turning over large segments of his airtime to directly promoting the project, unquote. Mark Cooper, a contributing editor of The Nation and a columnist for LA Weekly, told Alternet. And a May 2nd Christian Science Monitor Roundup piece on the Minuteman Project gave the group a generally favorable review while ignoring the controversial links of Minuteman Project participants to radical right-wing organizations. With dozens of television reporters on hand and satellite trucks in tow, the media swarmed the area, hunting video that might knock the Michael Jackson trial, the missing wife-to-be case, and or any boy-down-the-well stories out of a lead position on local and national newscasts. Hundreds of armed white men hanging out in the desert waiting for Mexican immigrants to cross the border had, if it bleeds, it leads potential. According to a Southern Poverty Law Center report on April 2nd, the Minuteman Project, quote, held a protest across the street from the U.S. Border Patrol headquarters in Naco, Arizona. Prominent among the demonstrators were two men who confided that they were members of the Phoenix chapter of the National Alliance, the largest neo-Nazi group in America. One of the two, who sat in lawn chairs throughout, held a sign with arrows depicting invading armies of people from Mexico, a sign identical to National Alliance billboards and pamphlets, except without the Alliance logo, unquote. By the way, I would note that in the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk, published by the National Alliance's publishing arm, National Vanguard, National Vanguard Press. There are a series of terrorist incidents with weapons of mass destruction that destroy much of the United States, result in a declaration of martial law, and the descendants of the SS and other white supremacists and Nazis have infiltrated the U.S. Army, and when martial law is declared, after much of the U.S. is destroyed by terrorist incidents using weapons of mass destruction, they take over. A similar scenario takes place in the Turner Diaries as well. Continuing. During the run-up to the demonstration, Sean Walker, a National Alliance official, told a reporter that they weren't, quote, going to show up as a group and say, "Hi, we're the National Alliance," unquote, "but we have members that will participate," unquote. In fact, the SPLC reported, National Alliance pamphlets were distributed in Tombstone and NACO, this predominantly Hispanic community, just 2 days before the Minuteman Project got going. "Non-whites are turning America into a third-world slum," they read. "They come for welfare or to take our jobs. Let's send them home now," unquote. But despite the presence of known white supremacists, the mainstream media generally gave the project a pass. Working for Change asked Mark Potok, the director of the Intelligence Project of the Southern Poverty Law Center, an organization monitoring hate groups, about the media coverage of the Minuteman Project, the group's right-wing connections, and Governor Schwarzenegger's endorsement. Due to the limitations of time, I'm simply going to sum up basically what the rest of this article talks about. Basically, one of the things Mark Potok goes on to point out is that the organizers of the organization, basically a fellow named Jim Gilchrist and Chris Simcox, appear to hold sympathies reflective, to a certain extent at least, of organizations like the Aryan Nations and the National Alliance. There's no shortage of racism and xenophobia in some of the pronouncements of some of these people. I will have the text of most of the rest of this article in the description for the Record 520 when it goes up on the web in the Spitfire website. But due to the limitations of time, we're going to proceed on from here. But again, note that Arnold Schwarzenegger, a man whose family has a Nazi background, a man who has expressed sympathy for Hitler himself, who has never in any way recanted his emphatic support for Kurt Waldheim, a Nazi war criminal, when he was running for president of Austria. The numerous programs about Schwarzenegger look into Governor Schwarzenazi, the triumph of the shill, as I labeled his administration, because it really should not come as too much of a surprise. His pandering to green interests and his media schmoozing notwithstanding, beneath the smile of Schwarzenegger lies something very, very sinister indeed. And his endorsement of the Minutemen, I think, is in many ways an indication of just where his administration might go. Another very interesting article concerns the association between a former Green Beret and Timothy McVeigh and the involvement of this former Green Beret in a number of milieu and incidents surrounding the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. Now, in For the Record program 456, among other programs, we've gone into some of the evidentiary tributaries connecting the first World Trade Center attack in 1993, the AMIA bombing in Argentina in 1994, the Oklahoma City bombing, and September 11th. Do look into that program for those details. It is more than a little interesting to see this Green Beret link here. I would note that a number of conspiracists, including right-wing conspiracy theorists, have basically maintained that Oklahoma City was a provocation, although I think it is understandable why they would have seen things in that regard. I'm afraid that the reality is considerably worse. What we're looking at is a fifth column inside of the United States that is basically subverting the country and is going to lead it basically to fascism. To a certain extent, the language here fails. The terminology is inadequate. But when looking at the presence of people like former Green Beret in the Aryan Nations and other elements, people like Dr. Larry Ford, a man who'd worked for the CIA, and for the South African Project Coast Biological Warfare Program, these are elements that are sympathetic to the Turner Diaries, and now with the former Soviet Union having gone down, their main target is the United States. I would note that in For the Record program 457, in an article from Vanity Fair of December of 2002 by Sebastian Junger, it noted that a former Green Beret who was associated with the Aryan Nations was not only training Islamo-fascist terrorists in the Three Corner area in Latin America, but according to Sebastian Junger's Argentine informant, he had allegedly provided logistical support to Mohammed Atta and company on September 11th. Following is from the McMurtain Daily Gazette from McMurtain County, Oklahoma. This is from July 20th of 2005, an article by J.D. Cash and Lieutenant Colonel Roger Charles, former U.S. Marine Corps. This article is titled FBI Document Links Former Green Beret to McVeigh and Bombing. And in addition to the former Green Beret, a Mr. Holloway, we're also going to see the links between the Oklahoma City / white supremacist milieu and Andreas Strassmeyer, the son of Gunter Strassmeyer, Helmut Kohl's former chief of staff, and the grandson of one of the founding members of the Nazi Party in Germany. The article reads in part, an FBI report of investigation, FD-302, obtained by this newspaper, contains never-before-published information and allegations regarding links between a former member of the Army's elite special forces, Timothy McVeigh, and the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. The man at the center of these revelations is David Michael Alexander Holloway, an individual whose life experiences appear to be as unusual as they are conflicted. Referred to as Dave, unquote, by his friends and business associates, the 48-year-old man who was the focus of the report served an 8-year stint in the U.S. Army, where Holloway earned the right to wear the elite Green Beret. Also included in that same report of investigation are references to Holloway's lengthy service to Kirk Lyons, a Black Mountain, North Carolina lawyer with a long history of representing members of the Ku Klux Klan, the Branch Davidians, and other fringe elements. And then there was Holloway's alleged role as a pilot for the CIA and his well-established relationship with the FBI. However, the most remarkable allegations contained in the February 25, 1997 FBI report are those regarding Holloway's eerie admissions that McVeigh failed to park the bomb truck in the best location in front of the Oklahoma City Federal Building that fateful April morning in 1995. The information contained in the report was provided by a person whose name and relationship to the FBI were redacted from the 302 to protect his identity. The statements and admissions attributed to Holloway are reported to have been made over a 3-day period during an underwater technologies convention in Houston, Texas. The confidential source for the report was debriefed by a special agent for the FBI on February 24th and 25th, 1997. After 8 years in the Army, Holloway told the source that he flew an airplane for the CIA for a period of 2 years before settling down, marrying his wife, and forming an affiliation with some of the most virulent and violent members of the far right in this country. After the service, Holloway said he worked for 2 years with the Corpus Christi Police Department as a diver. Skipping down. So how did Holloway become a negotiator for the government in cases involving the radical right? And what brought Holloway into contact with McVeigh? Central to the FBI's report from their source are detailed allegations concerning statements attributed to Holloway about his remarkably detailed knowledge of explosives and his precise knowledge of facts concerning the Oklahoma City bombing. Quote, while describing the Oklahoma City bombing, Holloway was able to provide technical details concerning the truck bomb and ANFO, ammonium nitrate fuel oil, to include its blast overpressure, fragmentation distances, and the deflagration with an alarming degree of specificity, the source told the FBI. Additionally, changes in Holloway's body language while describing the Oklahoma City bombing to include the rolling of his eyes when describing the truck not being parked in a place to wreak maximum destruction provided the indication that Holloway was attempting to communicate an involvement on his part in that bombing without verbally acknowledging participation. An exact copy of the redacted FBI 302 about Holloway may be found on this newspaper's website at www.mccurtain.com. The FBI report notes that, quote, at one point during their discussions, Holloway admitted to having spoken to Timothy McVeigh on the telephone 2 days before the detonation of the truck bomb outside the Oklahoma City Federal Building. In reference to that particular event, Holloway stated, the effing truck was too far away, unquote, and indicated it was not parked in the position which would inflict most damage on the building, unquote. Asked for Holloway's reaction to the document, Holloway's attorney Kirk Lyons said Tuesday Holloway has never met or talked to McVeigh. No stranger to Oklahoma bomb saga, Holloway has been a peripheral figure whose name has come up a number of times in news accounts focusing on the Oklahoma City bombing and some of the leading figures associated with the investigation. This newspaper first reported in early 1996 that Holloway was the man who spirited former paramilitary instructor at Elohim City, Andreas Karl Strassmeyer, also known as Andy the German, out of the United States to Berlin after the newspaper revealed Strassmeyer's links to McVeigh. Kirk Lyons is often referred to as the lawyer for American Klansmen. Among clients he has represented is Louis Beam, the former Grand Dragon of the Texas KKK and a legendary figure in the Aryan Nations movement. Once a person listed among the FBI's top 10 most wanted, unquote, Beam was captured in the mid-80s in Mexico by a team of Mexican police and FBI agents. The arrest was not without incident. Beam's young wife, Sheila, was arrested in the melee for allegedly shooting one of the Mexican policemen. Beam was quickly whisked to the U.S. to stand trial for his alleged role in a wide-ranging conspiracy to overthrow the federal government. His attractive and youthful blonde wife remained behind in a dingy Mexican jail, awaiting an uncertain future. And this particular story goes on to detail profound connections between Louis Beam, Andreas Strassmeyer, Mr. Holloway, and other people associated with the investigation into the Oklahoma City bombing and other white supremacists. It is a very, very interesting connection indeed. And indeed, it appears that Mr. Holloway helped to spirit Andreas Strassmeyer out of the country. I've done many programs about the Oklahoma City bombing. Go to the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com and use the search function to hunt down those programs dealing with the Oklahoma City bombing. I would note that many of the neo-Nazi and white supremacist elements in this country are aware of the provocation scenario, and as are, by the way, many of the Islamo-fascist elements around the world. And they're suggesting that all of these things are simply, quote, government, unquote, operations. There are elements associated in some way with the, quote, government, unquote, inside of them, but rather like a Latin American coup where people in the army, part of the government, overthrow the government and set up a new, quote, government in opposition to the last government. The terminology here is ineffective, but I would suggest to a lot of the amateur conspiracy buffs around that their analysis of a lot of these events is superficial and altogether inadequate, and that the reality is far, far worse. I also wonder, frankly, whether Holloway might have had something to do with an explosive device inside of the Oklahoma City building, as there may very well have been. There have been a number of accounts that allege just that. I think there's a very distinct possibility, though obviously I can't say for sure. I've alluded to the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com, a wealth of information. There is a search function, the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Each program is turned into a written article-length description. There are links to blog sites developed from the various program descriptions and a number of very, very useful links to websites maintained by sister station WFMU that is not only archiving the entire For the Record series on Real Audio and now MP3, but also is podcasting the For the Record shows as well. There are lectures available and also a page to click on in order to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like the things I'm talking about, there's nothing better you could do about it than to support the work that I'm doing. This concludes For the Record program number 520, update on white supremacists and neo-Nazis, being recorded on August 7th of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.